Well, good evening, everybody. Good evening. And my congratulations to those of you who came back. I was told that several folks had never had so many big words in such a short amount of time. And they've been practicing their big words for the last 24 hours. And so that's good. It's an interesting thing. And I may be the only guy around who feels this way, but I feel very strongly this way, so don't try and talk me out of it. For years and years, we've been telling everybody, make it simpler, and I disagree. It needs to be simple at a certain level, but if you've been a Christian for some time, there needs to be a point at which we say, I want to learn more, and I'm not afraid of learning some things that challenge me, that force me to grow and force me to learn. So I'm very encouraged to see this number of folks out to learn a little bit about what's going on in thinking in our culture. And we're doing this from a Christian perspective. Our goal, like I said when I was praying, our goal is not to win arguments. Although by God's grace, arguments can be won. But our goal is to bring people into the saving knowledge of Christ. And we're discovering in our culture that because of the way people think, there are many obstacles to that faith. It helps if we understand those obstacles, and it helps us if we understand that our mind is a central organ of faith, not just our heart. I want you to turn with me as we open this evening to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. I have a poster at my house. Actually, it's tattered and torn, and I had to take it down, but it shows a man standing kind of out on a hillside. And the caption is, he's standing there by himself and he's looking out at the mountains. And the caption says, if you would know the mind of God, you must learn to use your own. And it is a good reminder to us. In 2 Corinthians 10, it talks about how the Lord takes our thoughts captive. 2 Corinthians 10, though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 3, and then verse 4. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. What are we doing? Destroying speculations, logismos, the way people think. We're destroying philosophical systems that are raised up against the knowledge of God. The knowledge of God that we once had before the fall, before we all went crazy and decided not to worship God. Knowledge that was part of the original creation and that by God's grace, He brings us back into now as believers. And knowledge that transforms everything we say and do and think by God's grace and by the power of His Spirit. He's changing our speculations. He's changing our theories. He's changing the way we think about the way life works, destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Thoughts need to be brought into obedience to the Lord, and sometimes the toughest thoughts to be brought into obedience are the ones that we thought were already okay. And we never took the time to ask ourselves, I wonder if what I'm thinking is really Christian. I wonder what the Lord would think about what I'm thinking. In fact, oftentimes we don't even think about what we're thinking. And we definitely don't think about what we think about what we're thinking. But it's profitable. It's profitable to say, why do I think the way I think? Why do I think the way I do about my feelings? And why do I feel the way I do about my thinking? You're thinking, why am I here? Well, you know, there's more to this than just having warm feelings for the Lord. There's also saying, Lord, here's my mind, here's my gray matter. Would you please straighten it out? Please do it slowly. Don't correct everything at once. But I really want my thoughts to be your thoughts. I want to think your thoughts after you. What we're going to do this evening is a little bit of review from last night as we bring our thoughts into alignment with what the Lord says about the way our world thinks, kind of get an idea, once again, for how we got in the hopeless condition that our culture finds itself today. Metaphysics. What's metaphysics? Beyond the physical. And it has to do with things that are true, but that you cannot see and that you cannot count, but you're taking oftentimes someone else's word for it. Or you simply know intuitively there are some things out there. Metaphysics. You might not have thought of yourself as a metaphysician, but as a Christian, you are. You actually think about metaphysics, and you have a different metaphysic than anybody else who's not a Christian. If you're a knowledgeable Christian, you have a different way of dealing with the unseen world than even a lot of Christians do. A different way of thinking about value and ultimate truth, ultimate reality. Epistemology. The science of knowing, the philosophy of knowledge, how it is that we know what we know. You have an epistemology, you just didn't know what to call it. How we understand what we understand. That's epistemology. And it's at the very root of everything that goes on in the educational system. We take our little kids and we plug them into an educational system, Christian, non-Christian, whichever one for the moment. You just plug them in. Did you know that the teachers, they know about epistemology? Did you know that the people who taught the teachers and the people who taught the teachers who taught the teachers who taught the teachers, they know their epistemology real well. They know whether or not they believe in ultimate truth, and they know whether or not they can convey that to people, and they know how to turn a phrase and how to write a textbook in such a way that when a freshman comes into a college class and sits down and begins to read and hears the teacher begin to teach, that freshman's mind starts to be formed because these people understand about epistemology. They know that how you learn and how you know what you know is very, very important. And your epistemology as a Christian is different than the epistemology of the world. You learn things in a different way. Your whole idea of what is most important is different. The concept of ultimate truth is different. Ultimate reality is different. And even the normal idea of how truth is even defined is different and becoming more different with every passing day. In our own generation, within the next few years, we will see the definition of truth battled over powerfully. It's currently being fought over all the time, and we'll see the nature of the fight. I'll define it exactly for you tonight as we look into what postmodernism is about. Now, in the modern era and in the pre-modern era, people were asking big questions. In the pre-modern era, if you remember from last week, and again, as I run through this, and I'll only take about 5 more minutes or so to go through what we did last night, and then we'll slow down when we get into the new material. In the pre-modern period, they were asking the big questions. What is ultimate truth? What's the ultimate substance if it's there, or is it not tangible? Is there an impersonal one, or is there just one God? They were asking the big questions. And of course, in the Hebrew world, the prophets were speaking and God was making his name known to the nation of Israel, even at the same time. While the Greeks were asking the big questions, the Israelis were getting answers to the big questions. And on a practical level, people always ask and need to ask the 4 huge, meaningful questions of life. Where did I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? And what is the difference between right and wrong? And these are the things that we fight about right now, especially the last one. What's the difference between right and wrong? It's very much on the table today. Out in the marketplace of ideas, how can you tell the difference between right and wrong? What's your standard for it? Thinking people ask these questions. It's a mark of being human in a fallen world to want to know the answers to these things, and there are answers to them. In that brief history we looked at, we noticed that in pre-modernism, from antiquity through the 18th or into the 18th century, here was the motto. You can read it on the notes from tonight if you don't have them from last night. God, whether he was considered personal, multiple, or impersonal. Remember, we know he's personal. We know who we're talking about, but I'm speaking now for the Greeks, for instance, who didn't know, or the Hindus who didn't know. They still believed something was out there. So here's what they would say. God, whether personal, multiple, or impersonal, supplies order. The cosmos mystifies us. There must be someone or something out there, and if we pay attention, we can understand him or them or it, depending on who you're talking to. But the point is, there's something out there, it's bigger than me, and I want to know about it. I don't want to just go through life and make a living. I want to know why I'm here, and I want to know if there's something more. This is the question ever since the fall, and we'll talk more about the fall tomorrow night and how it affects how we think. So that was how they dealt with it. Now, ultimate truth, let's just work through these little four points. Ultimate truth and knowledge are available in this mindset, in the pre-modern mindset. Ultimate truth and knowledge are available, and they're desirable, in conjunction with metaphysical or supernatural. They actually would look for the metaphysical and the supernatural to try and figure it out. This was a good thing. They were looking around. Even though they were wrong about a lot of things, they realized that it wasn't all inside of them. Truth was considered to be that which corresponded with reality. I want you to remember that, because that's the same in the modern period as it was in the pre-modern period, and it's very different in the post-modern period. The people you go to school with, if you go to college right now, and the teachers you have if you go to college right now, don't believe this. But it was believed, and it is, and it was believed in the pre-modern period and in the modern period. Truth is considered to be that which corresponds to reality. Something is true just in case it actually meets with what's really going on. There is a real thing going on. Truth is when you know it and when you tell the truth, when you say it. It doesn't mean you can't be mistaken, but your idea of truth is when I say something, it means something that is real, okay? Truth is that which corresponds with reality. Knowledge of truth and reality was considered possible, but generally dependent on some form of revelation or on theoretical thought. They thought they would have to think about this. They were concerned that they should think about it. Now, remember both of those things, because we'll see how it changes as the years go by. Number two, the universe was considered open. Open to the supernatural, and the one they believed in those days was a bit too open, and we'll talk a little bit more about the Christian view of this tomorrow night, because there is a Christian view to this, and it's not quite the same as the pre-modern one, though you might think it would be. It's not. The universe was considered to be open, and I put in your notes, wide open. And there were some people who were very influenced by spiritual things without actually evaluating whether those spiritual things were really coming from God. But anyway, they considered the universe to be open in that respect. They considered there to be an interface between what we see and some sort of unseen world. That's an open universe. Number three, Christian theism, that means Christian thinking, generally reigned in Western Europe from the 5th century AD to the 17th century. All through that period of time, European thought and all the thought from all the generations for most of your ancestors was Christian. Even if they didn't really come to the Lord, they had a Christian worldview, and that was very important. Number four, but pre-modernism, with its too open universe, spawned a huge amount of superstition. And through the years, through what we call the Middle Ages, the medieval period, there was a great deal of superstition, though there were also some very sharp thinkers, within the church especially, who called the church back to a genuine understanding of what God had originally said. Nevertheless, it was quite a bit of mysticism, quite a bit of other isms like Neoplatonism and various things that had crept into thinking, plus a lot of political stuff in the church. And people got all fed up with it. And they said, that's it, we're not listening anymore. And over a period of time, and through the Renaissance and into the Enlightenment, there came the period we call modernism. Now, in modernism, there was a shift, as we saw last night. Roughly from the 18th into and through the 20th century, here's the motto: we can find order without God. The cosmos interests us. Doesn't mystify us, it just interests us, and we can find order specifically without God. There must be some big concepts out there. Notice the impersonal idea. Out there that we can find without God's help. The motto from the X-Files, the truth is out there. We will find it. Okay? Now, ultimate truth and knowledge in this period are available and desirable still, but without metaphysics and without the supernatural, and very specifically, that means without God. There was a rejection of God's presence in all of this. Truth was considered to be that which corresponded to reality. Am I going too fast? You following along in the notes okay? Okay, truth was considered to be that which corresponded with reality. Okay, same correspondence idea. Knowledge of truth and reality were considered possible, but catch this, absolutely not dependent on revelation. So you've got a shift right there. You've got a shift away from saying, I want to hear something from God, to the idea that I don't need to hear anything from God. In fact, anybody who says anything from God is suspicious. And this took over, you know, a couple hundred years for this to sort of take hold in the elite circles, but that's how it turned out. And I highlighted there for you, C, under B, the human intellect without God's grace is capable of the God's eye view. That's a phrase that actually was used, God's eye view of reality. In other words, able to see it all. They didn't mean it blasphemously. They said, when they said God's eye view, they meant the way things really are, the way God, if he were there, remember, most of them didn't believe he was there. But if he were really there, he sees the reality of it. You know, it's very interesting because the pre-moderns did believe God was there and that everything they learned it as God allowed them to. The moderns still had, now catch this, they still had to retain the idea that there was some sort of God's eye view, but without God. See, that's the correspondence idea of reality. If there is a reality out there, if there is a God, which we don't think there is, but if there were, he would know it. Now what they're saying is, he's maybe not there, but we can figure it out without him. Pretty much the worship of reason at this point. Notice the shift. By the way, let me ask you something practical. Those of you who do work, maybe you do some academic work, or maybe you don't do academic work, but you read, and you read things that are a little confusing. Do you actually ask the Lord to help you be smarter? You should. I mean, not because you need it, because what I mean, I do that. We all need it. But here's, you know, a lot of times when you're in school, unless you're in a Christian school, or unless you're in some place where somebody says to you, you know what, the Lord could open your mind and help you understand some of this if you asked him to. We don't even think about it. We just figure that, well, my brain is only as good as it's going to get. I got an old 386 computer here, and that's it. I'm trying to run Windows on it, and it is slow. I'm trying to run, you know, XP on my old computer, and that's just as good as it's ever going to get. Not necessarily. If you understand that the Lord is in charge of thought, why not ask him, Lord, give me sharper thinking. Help me to learn. Help me to grow. You know, your brain really doesn't get old. Barring chemical imbalances, your brain can actually work very, very well. We have this idea that, oh, well, young people think really quick and older people don't. That's a lot of times because we give ourselves excuses not to, not because our brain is really tired. And it's a lot of times because we have a lot more on our mind than we had when we were little. And you got to multitask. Anyway, the idea that God's knowledge is the knowledge we are learning is something to bear in mind. Now, it's interesting that in the modern idea of knowledge, they took out the idea of God, but they left the phrase God's eye view. And they had to in order to understand what reality was. You can pretend there's no God, but in order for thinking to work, you have to act as if God is there, even if you think he's not there. You have to act as if he's there. There has to be this God's eye view. Now, that is actually true, although we will find that people decided to try thinking without that as we get into our culture today. The universe came, number two, under B, in the modern period, the universe came to be thought of as closed now. This is a different thing from the pre-modern period. The universe is closed. What's a closed universe? No supernatural. It's mechanistic. It's all natural stuff. Everything you see came about by natural, impersonal forces. And the only way to explain it is by explaining it in impersonal terms. The minute you inject anything to do with a person with regard to anything that happens in the universe, you are not talking about a closed universe anymore. And what's that going to do to if a person has the view that the universe is closed, will they have any room in their definitions for intelligent design? Absolutely not. And this is exactly why intelligent design is considered non-science. It's because it's defined out of existence by a closed universe. The idea that the universe is closed is simply a given. It's a presupposition in this worldview. And interestingly, many people who claim to be Christians and who do scientific work actually live 6 days a week in a closed universe and work as though the universe is closed. And then on the seventh day, when they go to church, can't figure out why they don't feel very close to God. It's just what I talked about last night. Their worldview, they're shifting from one worldview to another. Most of the time, they actually live as though the universe is closed, as though God doesn't care, he's got nothing to do with them. And then on Sunday, they come and they try and act spiritual, and they can't figure out why it's not working for them. Well, it's this right here. The universe was closed in the modern period and remains so for a great many people to this day, perhaps even the majority in a lot of circles. The main characteristics of modernism, and we talked about these four big words, rationalism. What's rationalism? Has to do with your mind. Your mind can figure it out. Empiricism, what's empiricism? The only thing your mind has to work with is what your senses pick up. That's empiricism, what your senses get. Foundationalism, now that's a kind of a weird one. Foundationalism means there are some things you can always trust, such as the laws of logic, and you can use those to build thoughts. And this was very, very big in the modern period. Is this true? Are you a foundationalist? Are you sure? Okay, all those of you who think you're foundationalist, raise your hand. Oh, no, I see it. I want to see where it's going to go. I mean, am I going to be in the majority? Okay, those of you who don't think you're foundationalist, raise your hand. Aha, okay, well, so those of you who aren't thinking about it at all, raise your hand. Okay. Well, you are foundationalists in all probability, at least to a certain extent. There are certain laws of logic that everybody does use. In fact, even people who deny foundationalism and deny the idea of logic use logic to deny it. That's how you can tell that foundationalism is really down to something important. However, in the modern period, foundationalism was way overestimated. They really thought they could figure literally everything out, and with absolute certainty. And this became obvious to them over a couple hundred years that this wasn't true, that they could figure everything out with absolute certainty without revelation from God, completely on their own. And this depressed them no small amount, okay? Now, remember that, because when you get into the postmodern period, one of the things they hate is foundationalism, and that's why. They're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But they're really making a mistake when they do it. Foundationalism is important to the modern period. Also, skepticism, oddly enough, is important to the modern period. What is skepticism? Anybody? Doubt. Whoa, that was pretty clear. Everybody knew that. Skepticism is essentially the idea that you cannot know whether something is right or wrong or true or false. That's skepticism. That you cannot know whether something is right or wrong or true or false. It's not denying whether it's not saying it's false, necessarily. It's just saying I can't know it. Okay, that's skepticism. And radical skepticism, radical doubt, goes all the way back into the BC years, clear back into the Greek thinkers, Protagoras. Remember we talked about him? Now, so don't think that this is something new in the modern period, but it began to grow powerfully in the modern period, became very important in certain elite circles, and was like a virus passed into the next generation with an increase in effect. This becomes, this skepticism, this, you know, begin with doubt and proceed with caution, becomes an absolute acid in the minds of thinkers over the next couple of generations. So watch for that as we move into the postmodern material. Now notice that the main characteristic in all of this is that ultimate truth could and should be found by human thought without God in it. And it's all about thinking without God. We should be able to think without God. We should be able to stand outside of God's truth and evaluate whether or not we're going to believe in Him. We should be able to think completely autonomously on our own. And so many generations of people were taught that this is the ultimate in virtue, is to set yourself outside your faith and do not allow whatever your faith is to have anything to do with what you do on a daily basis, because you should be able to think entirely on your own. And if all truth is God's truth, which in a sense is the case, then whatever you think in your own perfectly functional brain, God should agree with. Because once you found out it's true, since God probably, if He's there, already knows it's true, everything you find out, God will agree with. Anybody see a problem with this? Yeah, but see, if you tie into this idea that your brain functions just fine without any truth from God, you can see how people would get this way. And this is the characteristic of the period. It's characteristic of many people today. Many church-going Christians actually live this way right now. The three great thinkers of the period, and there were others too I've probably overlooked. If you read on this subject, you probably have a favorite or two that I overlooked. But René Descartes from, from whose name comes the name Cartesian. Have you ever heard the name, the word Cartesian? It comes from René Descartes. And he said, I will doubt everything that I cannot rationally prove. Then came along David Hume, who said, well, I will doubt everything that cannot be empirically demonstrated. You see the emphasis on doubt. What this is a growth of skepticism that's growing during this period of time. And look at the dates. We're talking 18th century, right when our country was being born, right when the big thinkers in our country were doing their thing, this was happening in the elite circles. Immanuel Kant, probably the most important, single most important thinker in the last 250 years on the subject, believe it or not, even though people sometimes don't know what his name is, I tell you, I guarantee you, your thinking has been affected by Immanuel Kant. And he said, we will pick up where David Hume left off, and we will have to admit to ourselves that we have to doubt that humans can acquire any real, catch this, non-empirical knowledge at all. Now look at that again. See, Kant said, you cannot know, Kant said, you can't, remember? Kant said, you can't know any non-empirical knowledge. There is no non-empirical knowledge. Now remember, I had you draw a circle on the paper there, draw a line through the circle at the halfway mark, right across, laterally. On the top, you write noumenal, N-O-U-M-E-N-A-L. N-O-U-M-E-N-A-L, noumenal. That's what he called it, the noumen. Have you ever heard anybody say, I sense the numinous? That's where they get this word. It means stuff that's unseen. It's all the essences, all the stuff that we talked about ultimate truth. Kant put that all up there, and then you got this little line in between. It's kind of a wall in the way we think. And then in the lower half of the circle, phenomenal, P-H-E-N-O-M-E-N-A-L, phenomenal. Down there is the phenomena, the stuff you get to see and work with, the stuff you can use empiricism for. And what Kant said was, we all live in the lower half of the circle, and we have no idea what's going on in the upper half of the circle and no way to empirically prove it. So let's, for all intents and purposes, leave everything in the upper half of the circle completely out of our thinking. And you know who we put there? God, anything to do with metaphysics, essences, the way things really are, our ability to understand reality, ultimate total reality, our ability to answer all the big questions, that's all up in there. He also put self in there, interestingly, which is capital S self, meaning you don't even know yourself. There's a lot of stuff about yourself that mystifies you. The real essential you. When you think about it, that's true. And he realized it. These guys thought a lot about this. And so he said, well, that must be part of the numinous as well. I'm putting that up there in that upper thing. And there's this wall between these two. And honest and truly, from the lower half, you cannot reach the upper half. And he made this very, very clear. He was not saying that there's no upper half. He was actually something of a theist. He was just sort of an agnostic. He just said, well, we can't know. And interestingly, he said, we can't know for sure if God is there, but he wrote a whole nother book that said, but we have to pretend he is, otherwise we won't be able to live. Truly, I mean, that's in simple words, but he said, we have to act as if God is there, otherwise there's no society because there's no justice and there's no God to judge us. And if we don't have a God to judge us, if we don't have any accountability, our lives are going to go haywire real quick and we'll do all kinds of bad stuff and we won't care. And so he realized, if everybody believed what he said, that you could never really know about God, and they really started to act as if there was no God, even he realized in the 18th century, society would go to pot. And it has, because a lot of people believed Kant. Now Kant, everybody took the first half of what he said. Yeah, you know, we can't understand all that heavy-duty metaphysical stuff. There's no way we can reach it. There's no way we can be sure of it. We can't measure it. We can't put it in a vial and add chemicals and make it do stuff. We have no control over it. They believed that, but they didn't believe him when he said, but you have to believe as if there's a God, because there's something in the human soul that doesn't want to believe in God. So Immanuel Kant, the third great name, well, the guys who took him and took his material, there were other people too who didn't like this and the romantics and various other philosophical positions, but they all agreed on one thing. The human mind is all there is that can figure things out. They all agreed we don't want to talk about God. The only people talking about God during this time was the church. The Protestant church was talking a lot about God. In fact, they were arguing with the Catholics during this time about God. But in the world system, even the Romantics and the other philosophical schools, they all agreed it's all about the human brain. We can't really reach the other side. We don't understand anything from our side. So we're going to have to make up something for ourselves. And so we ended up with nihilism and existentialism, two really big words. It means nothingism. Nihil is just the German word for nothing. And nihilism means nothingism. And existentialism is the word for existence. And existentialism is a huge, big, huge category. But in a nutshell, to oversimplify it, it simply means, yeah, you can't know anything for sure, but don't be depressed. You can pretend. And you can say, I have meaning that I've made for myself. My existence is meaningful because I decided to make it that way. And that's where, practically speaking, where existentialism was. Albert Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre and that whole field. They came out of the idea that Kant gave them. And you can see why, if you don't believe that God has really spoken, if your epistemology stops with Immanuel Kant, you have got to try and make meaning out of that lower half of that circle. And that is very depressing because you know you're going to die and you know you don't have the big answers. And you know that everybody you go to doesn't have them either. But you've already been told you can't trust anything God has ever said. And so it leaves you in this terrible feedback loop, and that's where we ended last night. When they were finished with the Enlightenment project at the end of World War II, Europe was in ruins. In the mid part of the 19th century, everybody was really up. Actually, from the 18th century on, it was like, wow, we are getting smarter. Everything's getting better. We're finding so much stuff out. Look how smart we are. We don't need God. We don't need anything. We're discovering new countries. We're discovering new technologies. Look at all this stuff. And then there was the American Revolution. And that philosophy helped us with our revolution. It gave us a philosophical reason to say we don't believe in kings. We can make our own laws. And we'll do the red, white, and blue. Remember what I talked about last night? And we will do the liberty thing. It was very much a part of the thinking of that. And then the French Revolution came. And so both of these revolutions altered Western history powerfully, all because of this Enlightenment thinking. But a very, very bad thing was taking place. This implicit atheism, this practical atheism, was eating away at the soul of the elite thinkers. And it was at the end of the 19th century that Nietzsche started to actually say what everyone had suspected among these circles for some time. And that is, we don't need God at all. Let's simply take him out of the equation and admit it. Let's stop going to church and stop faking it. Because we don't believe the Bible anymore, and we don't believe in miracles because Hume told us they can't happen, and we don't believe that we can reach the noumenal. We know we can't, but we also don't believe that anybody from the other side ever reached us. So we're stuck. Let's just admit it and try and do it on our own. Very, very depressing. And what it did was all of that happy upward mobility for the human brain ended in August of 1914, the beginning of the First World War. And then the Depression, and then the Second World War, and then the horrible, horrible realities that came to light of Auschwitz and what Stalin had done to 30 million of his own people. These guys were atheists. 200 years ago, people were saying, what we need is more atheists and less church people. Now in the 20th century, they were saying, wait a minute. These are atheists. These are people who have no reason to be moral about anything. And look what they have done. Look what modernism has done. What had happened is they built a bridge to nowhere and then burned the one behind them. Philosophically, they could not turn around. They're just not going to turn around and say, well, we've decided to believe in God again. Meanwhile, the church was growing by leaps and bounds. The 19th century was a huge missionary century. There were people going everywhere, but in the elite thinking structures, it was getting into the 20th century, it was getting very, very depressing. And by the end of the 20th century, this pall hung over everything, especially in European philosophy. Especially in European philosophy. I want you to picture Europe in ruins, not just physically and financially, but morally and intellectually. in ruins. That's the way they saw it. And smoke from the wars and smog from the immoral human condition just hanging over everything. And that was when Jean-Paul Sartre said, this is useless. This is meaningless. Humanity is a useless passion. That was what they said, the existentialists. Humanity is a useless passion. The best you can do is live the best life you can, enjoy everything, get the gusto, live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse, and pick the day you're going to die. Ernest Hemingway, the archetypical 20th century man, said, I will live it up. And he did. And then he said, I'm done. He took out his favorite rifle and killed himself. Because that's all there is. And people seem to know this in their souls. When we come into the postmodern period, it begins in the 1980s. It actually started in the 60s. They started writing about it in the 60s, and it was being felt even in the 40s. And it ties back into Nietzsche's thinking clear back in the previous century. But it wasn't called postmodernism for a while. Here's the motto, and I'll let you write it down as you go. Well, we didn't need order anyway. Chaos is good. Who cares about the cosmos? Modernism tried to straighten us all out and almost killed all of us. We need to stop trying to figure out ultimate truth. We didn't need order anyway, first blank. Chaos is good, second blank. Who cares about the cosmos? Modernism tried to straighten us out and almost killed all of us. We need to stop trying to figure out ultimate truth and just pull together in our global village. There are lots of big ideas out there, and we should honor them all, because the ultimate truth is that there is no ultimate truth. There is only survival. That's all that matters now. And so we have reality TV shows called Survivor. Reality TV is an oxymoron. Because they're on an island with a huge resort, you know, 30 feet away. But the goal is to find out who gets thrown off and who survives. And it's an interesting commentary. Now, postmodernism is essentially it is a sociological and philosophical trend. It is, as I'm going to point out in a minute, it is a sociological and philosophical trend. We talk about postmodernism. By the way, the word is overused. It's kind of stretchy now. In fact, it's even sort of passé, in Europe anyway. But it's still useful for us. It's what comes after modernism, when people are sick of modernism. It's a sociological and philosophical trend. A movement in mass feeling and general worldview is articulated by several key literary philosophical thinkers, Jacques Derrida, Richard Rorty, Michel Foucault, Stanley Fish, and others, and you'll see names if you do reading in the field. These guys are the big guns. They were writing mostly in the 60s and 70s on this, and then it hit the oxygen and began to just blitz the intelligentsia and the literature and philosophy, mostly literature, actually. It really has affected the lit departments in universities. It's a sociological thing. The term does not originate from philosophy or science. It originates from sociology. It's an observational thing, this thing called postmodernism. And even though it carries philosophical weight now, they actually coined the phrase in 1979 in a book called The Postmodern Condition. That was where they first started to call it postmodernism. Before then, it was just a headache. It was just a headache left over from the smog and the gun smoke of modernism. And everybody was saying, what are we going to do? We got to think of something, and I'm sick and tired of thinking of ultimate truth, and I can't go back to church. So let's make up something new. Well, they started calling it something in 79. They started calling it postmodernism, and it took on all kinds of different forms. There's all kinds of different ways that it affects society. We're not going to talk about all of them. What I want to point out mostly is that this is not a cohesive philosophy. Like Marxism, Marxism was Karl Marx sitting down and taking some of the stuff he'd learned from Hegel and various other guys and writing a whole philosophy of world history and how things ought to be. That's not this. Postmodernism is not like somebody sat down and wrote a philosophy. Postmodernism is a feeling that came out of the grassroots of frustration and fear and foreboding and depression left over from modernism's failure, basically. Modernism promised all this success and everything and then blew it so bad. And it's this depression about the condition of the human soul. And coupled with the fact that they couldn't talk to God about it because they'd already defined him out of existence. Modernism had defined God out of existence. So now what are you going to do when you're done with modernism? Make up something new. Here are the characteristics of postmodernism. Now there are several of these, and we're going to kind of move our way through them because it's easier to describe it than it is to define it. And when you see the description of it, do you remember stories, or maybe you were involved in the Pacific Theater during World War II, the spotters that were on the islands that would watch for the Japanese planes to come over? They did not have to know everything about the plane. They just had to know what it looked like, right? They had a little chart. When they looked at the thing, and they looked at the thing, and they looked at the chart, and they phoned it in, and they said, it's one of these. Well, it helped them understand that all they had to know was what it looked like. And that's all we need to know, essentially, about postmodernism, especially in a couple of particular areas, just what it looks like, so that we can understand how it affects how we think. And it does affect how you think, I promise you. And how people think when you witness to them. Because there are folks who, when you witness to them and you talk about anything to do with ultimate truth or exclusivity of the gospel, they just look at you like a calf at a new gate. They're thinking, where did you come from? What planet are you from? And it's because of this line of thinking. So learning to identify it is helpful. A, here's the big deal. Skepticism triumphs. It is the triumph of doubt. Skepticism is the main thing. Ultimate truth and knowledge are not available and not desirable. That's a first. Skepticism triumphs. That's the first blank. Ultimate truth and knowledge are not available and not desirable. We can't find them, and that's really good. We don't want them. Now, that's very different than the other two positions. See, all through history, people wanted knowledge, and they thought it was available. Ultimate knowledge, real knowledge, knowledge of the real, and so on. But now, in this day and age, or in the postmodern thing, because of the sickness of what has happened, skepticism triumphs. What we really want is more skepticism. We've gotten a taste for this acid, and we like it. Ultimate truth and knowledge are not available, not desirable. The unaided human intellect is still the only source of knowledge. Take note of that. But it doesn't get us anywhere important. All you've got is your brain. Oh, yeah? Is it good? Oh, your brain is wonderful. Will it tell you anything important? No. There's nothing really worth knowing. What can we know for sure? 2 + 2 = 4. Oh, that's really life-changing. But that's it. Now, actually, it's a little more complex than that. But that's basically what's happening. Triumph of skepticism. And we don't want this knowledge available. It is not available. Why? See, number two, not available. Why? Because the Kantian divide cannot be crossed. We've already talked about that. See, it's not available because Kant said you can't get there, and they pretty much everybody agrees on it. You can't get there from here. Like modernism, Enlightenment rationalism, postmodernism begins not with God's knowledge, but with man's knowledge. Always remember, they adopted from modernism. They got it from modernism. You are on the lower half of Kant's circle. You can't reach out and know anything on your own. Now, I know there are spiritists, and we'll talk a little bit about that maybe next time more. But generally speaking, this is the elite systems. These are the people who do the major educations for people in Europe and the United States. These are the folks who taught the professors that you send your kids to at State College. It is scary. It is scary when you realize that what their headspace is, that ultimate knowledge is not available and not even desirable. And so it began with man's knowledge, and that was all. Remember Descartes said, I will doubt until I am certain, and I know who I am because I have doubted, the cogito. What's God's name in English? I am. What did man say in modernism, and what is he still saying in postmodernism? I am. I am. This is direct competition for sovereignty. I just had to inject a little theology in there. I just couldn't go on with this depressing stuff. So Descartes, though he was a theist, started with the capital letter I, and it stayed that way all through the modern period. And in postmodernism, this is the reigning characteristic. It all starts with the I. It starts with me. But unlike early modernism, in your notes, it comes to the conclusion that universal knowledge and certainty about truth are impossible. Nothing important can be known for sure. Truth is not, number three, truth is not considered to be that which corresponds with reality. What? You mean to tell me that truth is not what corresponds with reality? That's exactly what they're saying. Truth is not about what corresponds with reality. Why would they say that? We can't know reality ultimately. So, truth is not what corresponds. See the big difference here between what the other two worldviews? Because reality is out of reach, truth, which we can't live without, must be redefined or reinvented. Instead of corresponding to reality, truth now coheres within itself. The definition of truth is coherence in these circles. All it has to do to be true is not violate its own logic. So what? Wait a minute, that means you can have more than one truth that are all kind of out there in the truth space, and as long as they don't violate their own logic, then all of them can be true at the same time because there's no ultimate truth. Yeah, that's exactly right. The definition of truth, that's why people who understand truth really is correspondence to reality are talking to a person who believes truth is really just agreeing with itself, and they cannot agree on what's right and wrong. Well, duh, because the person in the coherence thing doesn't even understand the language of the person with a correspondence view of truth. Are the words too big? You guys following here? This is taking over the intellectual world, the coherence thing. It's not because truth and reality might not exist. They might be out there. It's because they cannot be known to exist. And this is classical skepticism. Radical postmoderns don't trust language. Because they think, write that one in C, language, because they think it simply is an extension of our own perceptions, a sort of game we play to shape reality the way we want it. Say, oh, come on, do they really believe that? Yes, they do. And so do you to a certain extent. Oh, I do not. Yes, you do. When you go to buy a car, have you noticed how sometimes a bit of a spin will come your way regarding certain facts and certain directions? Or when you're watching television and they're selling cars on television and they say, this is the last greatest sale and we're running out of cars. Do you believe them? No, we know they're lying. We've adjusted to it. We've been lied to for so long that lying. Actually, one person said, in our world, lying is actually a form of legitimate communication. Where did we get this idea? By abusing language under certain circumstances. But these folks take it farther. They say, listen, all language is that way. It's not just advertising language. It's not just sales language. It's not just the political spin doctors that we're sort of used to and we adjust for this. All language, they say, is manipulative. All language creates reality. That's what they're saying. And so they're saying it's not, you can't believe what people say and you can't believe what they write. Now hold that thought, because there are some answers for it. But this is where it's going. They don't like D. They don't like foundationalism. They don't like foundationalism. Well, obviously, because it seems to lead to some form of certainty, which they have already decided not to believe. I didn't get the word believe in there. It just says be. So I started to spell it for you. And you can finish the spelling of believe. They don't like foundationalism because they don't want certainty. They've already decided certainty can't be had. We don't want certainty about hardly anything. So foundationalism is a bad word in this culture. And you will hear it, if you read on the subject, it will be spoken of in very dark terms. You know, this is the great irony. You pay good money to go and hear a professor tell you, you can't know anything. It really is kind of crazed. And your guess is as good as mine, but people are lining up at universities to go and hear this. And don't get the impression every university teaches this all the time, but a significant number do. Almost all of the secular ones do. And it might surprise you to know, some of the Christian ones. I sat with, not that long ago, a couple of administrators from a very prestigious Christian university, and they both said foundationalism doesn't work. And I said, yes, it does. Cartesian doesn't. Cartesian foundationalism doesn't work, but critical realism works, and everybody uses it, and that's a form of foundationalism. It means I can figure out what's wrong with what I'm hearing, critical realism, and I can still build a reliable truth structure. That's critical realism. It's a form of foundationalism, and these guys hadn't even entertained the idea. And so this is a battle going on all around, and as far as I'm concerned, why people are getting into university and being told they can't know anything for sure, I think it's senseless, frankly. And I think that if you get involved in the discussion, you ought to point out the obvious. If you can't trust words, how do I know what you're telling me is true? Because they all expect you to believe them, of course. And if they wrote a book, they don't want you to deconstruct it. They want to be taken seriously. So the thing will probably implode in the long run, but you need to know that it's this deep. It's this weird. It's this far from what we would call common sense. And even common sense, that is really railed on. I mean, you talk about common sense, they just absolutely have kittens, because you believe that you know something and can actually tell someone else they're wrong. All of this from radical skepticism. It's an acid. Here's the deal under foundationalism. Number one, the truth is probably not out there. That's the way they would fill that in. The truth is probably not out there. Number two, and even if it is, our mind cannot find it. That's actually the reality. That is the new insight of the 21st century. The truth is probably not out there. And if it is out there, our mind cannot find it. Following Kant's break between the phenomenal and the noumenal, but not following Kant's moral argument for God's existence, which he postulated as the only means of establishing society on earth. You see, they believed part of what Kant said, and they didn't believe the rest of it. Well, you can't live without something that you call reliable. How do you get it? Truth is arrived at by consensus of the community. The community votes on it. They decide. And then it becomes truth. We just agree this is truth. This is the truth we're using right now. That's all there is to it. There's no ultimate truth. Don't bother us with that. This is the truth we're doing. It's socially constructed reality. Say, oh, come on. Do people do this? Absolutely. Listen to this quote. Sociologists note that society cannot hold together without something that is shared, a social reality. Some sociological theorists have argued convincingly that what is shared is, for the most part, socially constructed. Namely, that there is little actual reality beyond that produced by the process of social interaction. This is the principle of the social construction of reality, the idea that our perception of what is real is determined by the subjective meaning that we attribute to the experience. In this way, the process of social interaction and subjective meaning we give to the things arising from it actually determine what we see and what we call a fact. We're making it up, basically. Hence, there is no objective reality in itself. And by the way, Ding an sich, that's exactly what Kant called it, the reality in itself, the thing in itself. It's interesting that they quote Kant directly in English. There is no objective reality in itself. Things do not have their own intrinsic meaning. We subjectively impose meaning on these things. End quote. Say, well, what wacko person wrote that? Some dusty old library, some place that nobody ever reads? That is from the current Soch textbook at RCC. One of my students from the college just gave me the textbook, and I started reading it. And that's not all. I'm dogging pages on this textbook. They're giving it to 17, 18-year-old kids. And this is the philosophical framework they're being taught. They walk in, they open their brain, and the teacher just pours this stuff in. It's radical skepticism. You know, when you've had enough of it and you're kind of bleary-eyed, then they clip your head shut again and give you a little piece of paper that says you're educated now. I'm not down on education. Education is a good thing, but education, when education tells you that knowledge doesn't exist, one must ask some questions.